Here we go.
Welcome to BP WrigleyCast. This is episode 13. My name is Carlos Portogrero, joined as usual by Isaac Bennett, Ryan Davis, and Joel Reese. The Cubs had a bit of a, they had a good week, but it was kind of slow with two games rained out. Cubs went 3-1, and we're gonna start with kind of some part-time players and kind of their performance this week. So I just wanted to highlight real quick some numbers that I ran over this week. At the top of the order, Dexter Fowler and Jason Hayward had a pretty bad week. Hayward went 0-17. Dexter Fowler went 3-15. But the guys that we're going to talk about are, we're going to talk about Matt Caesar. We're going to talk about Tommy La Stella. La Stella went 2-6. Matt Caesar went 3-5 with a big grand slam. And Javi Baez went 3-6. So the top of the order, some of the big names didn't do so well. And the team still went 3-1. So, you know, you'll take it. It's a good week. Isaac, what's your take on kind of these players like Matt Caesar and Tommy La Stella kind of stepping up and coming through when they're needed, when some of the other guys in the lineup aren't doing so hot?
I think it's just a testament to the depth of the team. I think you kind of have to actually separate La Stella and Caesar. Caesar's a really good defensive player, and La Stella's probably at best below average, but La Stella, in my opinion, is a little bit more special with the bat than people give him any credit for. He's been a bit of a minor league journeyman, but he's got a 404 on base in the minor leagues, and you know, Matt Trueblood also pointed out to me today that he's actually walked more than he struck out in the major leagues in the short stints that he's had, so I still think that the fan base and other people may actually underestimate just the quality of hitter that La Stella is, so I think they're both valuable bench pieces. I like seeing La Stella get some starts while he's hot. I like that Madden's riding the hot hand with him. But I do think that he is probably the piece that has a longer-term implication on this team rather than Matt Caesar. Sorry, Joel.
You'll eat those words.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably true, but only maybe because Caesar's out of options and he may hit a roster crunch at some point. But, I think as bench players, you need to be able to do at least a few things really, really well, or at least, you know, with La Stella, he does one thing extremely well, and that's, you know, hit, make contact, get on base. But I like the fact that Caesar, you know, he can pinch run, and he's fast, so he can steal a base. He plays really good defense in the outfield. He's reliable out there, and the fact that he's shown that he actually can put the bat on the ball and even generate a little bit of power, if he can consistently do that, then, you know, I don't know why you'd need to give him up at any point or put him on waivers, because he's like the perfect bench outfielder. You know, speed, defense, young, hits the ball, and makes like less than $1 million. So, yeah, at this point, they're doing really well with their bench guys.
Yeah, I second that on Matt Caesar, especially any guy that can have 13 consonants in a row without a vowel there is admirable.
Yeah, that's like his best thing, I think.
The thing I like about him, he reminds me of Junior Lake, but with superior defense. And the reason is, you know, you would see, I remember Junior Lake one time I tweeted a screenshot of his MLB.com highlight page or player page, and he had a highlight of him bunting for a base hit next to him hitting a long home run, and with Caesar hitting the grand slam this week, and then today he bunted for a base hit. It was a beautiful bunt single. I just love seeing guys that, you know, can hit the ball a long way. Every now and then, Caesar's not known for that, and then turning around and bunting for a base hit and using his speed. I just love that.
Yeah, you know, Caesar is it's funny because there are certain plays that come to mind when I think of him, and I think about I think it was last season, Area had like a perfect game going, I want to say, or a no-hitter, and then some guy roped one into the gap, and Caesar laid out and wasn't within like 10 feet of the ball, but he is like still dove, and you know, it was like if he had made that catch, it would have been amazing. But you know, the thing is with La Stella, I heard today, you probably saw he came up in the ninth inning and struck out, and That was his first strikeout all season, and I think it was 33 plate appearances.
Against the guy he got traded for.
Yeah, that was that nice little twist there too. So that was, I mean, I think it's, I wonder about this though. Isaac, you were talking about how he's the perfect, Caesar is the perfect bench outfielder, and it's true, but won't there be some sort of roster crunch at some point? I guess if Schwarber's out for the year, then maybe not. But are the numbers going to come up? Because everybody knows, as we talked about, he doesn't have any options left. So.
Yeah, I don't think that there's really any reason. Unless I'm drawing a blank here, I don't see any reason why you'd need to put him on waivers. They've got 8 men in the bullpen. You would assume that at some point, one or two of those guys are going to have to go on the DL for some reason. I'm drawing a blank on any reason why you'd have to get rid of Matt Caesar to call somebody else up. There could be something completely unexpected, like a trade, but at this point, they need what he brings to the table. I mean, that's just, like, if you subtract him out of the equation, who on the roster could you pinch run in the ninth inning, knowing you need to steal a base? Who could you bring off the bench for Jorge Soler, knowing I'm going to, upgrade the defense by putting this outfielder in left field? I mean, is that Chris Bryant? I think we saw pretty clearly in the top of the ninth inning today that it's not Chris Bryant. He's, going to be fine out there in left field, but he's definitely not a fantastic outfielder at this point in his career. So, I don't see any reason why you would be getting rid of Matt Caesar.
Well, maybe with him and Bryant, that handsome quotient is too high on the team.
Can you handle it, Joel? Can you handle it?
I don't know. It's a big question.
And don't hear me wrong. I like Matt Caesar. I think he's staying around for sure. I guess I meant beyond this year. I think for 2016, the roster is pretty well set. And frankly, contrary to popular opinion, Jorge Soler is the guy that doesn't probably belong in the major league roster right now. But I think Caesar's here to stay. I just think that Listella is probably a guy that's going to be here for 4 or 5 years and contributing for a long time.
Yeah, my thing that I wrote right around when Schwarber got hurt about Soler possibly going back down to AAA, it doesn't look so stupid now, does it?
It never was stupid, actually. Can I just say on Listella's strikeout today, too? What was that bunt attempt in that situation? My wife was yelling at the screen for that. I don't know if that was a Madden call or what, but I was really surprised by the bunt attempt.
It was a bunt and run, right?
It was so weird, yeah.
Yeah, they were trying to take him by surprise, I think, because Zobrist was on first, and he was running. He was running with it. So I think they were trying to just shock the hell out of everybody, maybe get him over and get a Listella on first base. I mean, that's the way I read it, but
it was so weird though, because he squared so early. So if they were trying to surprise him, he squared way too early.
I'm kind of wondering if he squared really early to get the infielders to run in, and maybe the reason they got popped up was because maybe he was trying to pop bunt it past them.
Over them,
like, that is talk about overthinking.
Yeah.
That's actually a good point.
He held the bat so high, that was just my initial reaction watching him do it, is I thought, oh, he looks like he's trying to pop bunt it, like, over the infielders as they run in. It's just, I mean, it could be just, my way I interpreted it, and could be very wrong, but that's just the way I saw it.
The other thing, that entire at-bat just befuddled me, because the first pitch was 5 inches outside and got called a strike.
Yeah, that was ridiculous. Not even close.
Then they tried a bunt attempt, and then the last swing was something I've never seen him do, which was just look completely awful on a string.
Yeah, well, I think, clearly we lost the trade on that one because we lost to Vizcaino.
Yeah. Isaac, you mentioned you got in a nice incisive dig about Soler there, and I know we had this discussion a couple weeks ago, but I think that Ryan and I were both pretty bullish on Soler, and I'm not saying I'm not, but he is starting to worry me because – I know that, his performance in the playoffs last year is kind of like everyone thought, well, he's turned the corner. I've started to wonder if that was the outlier, and what we're seeing seems to be more the norm now. And I'm not saying that that's the case, but I'm starting to get a little worried about that.
Yeah, I'm definitely not giving up on Jorge Soler, and I don't want anybody to take it as that way. I'm still a fan. I still think he's got the bat to be a major leaguer, but he's a one-dimensional player, and when you're a one-dimensional player, that one dimension has to be outstanding, kind of contrary to the Matt Caesar, where he's starting to do everything decently. So Lair's a one-dimensional guy, and what I found when I did his profile last year was pretty scary to me, is that I believed he could be abused down and away, and that they'd found a hole on him. And unfortunately, I think we're still seeing that. First pitch today and is only at bat. Granted, tough situation coming against a reliever in a pinch hit situation, but kind of a breaking pitch down. He hacks at it and weakly grounds out. I don't know. I think he's going to continue to get exposed by major league pitching, and I'd like to see him at this point get some more regular starts in AAA where he can maybe work himself out again.
Now, Isaac, when you say you see him as a one-dimensional player, I'm assuming you're talking about his power, but wouldn't you call his ability to control the strike zone, get on base via the walk, another one of his tools?
I don't really mean his power. I mean his ability at the plate in general. I view him as a professional hitter, kind of intrinsically who he is. I don't think he's a great base runner. He obviously isn't a very good defensive player. So I'm saying all the value he's going to bring is going to come in the box.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the low and away pitch that they've exposed him, and I wrote something, I want to say it was last September, about Soler, where I basically looked at it and said, the pitch he struggles with is the low and away pitch, and if he can learn to lay off that pitch, he can be a monster, because everywhere else in the zone, he crushes the ball.
That's right.
And then in October, he magically started laying off that pitch. And we saw what happened. I mean, he started crushing the ball and taking walks. And now, again this year, he's struggling with the low and away pitch. I don't want to be too reactionary to a first few weeks, especially because it's been cold. He hasn't had regular playing time. They played, what, four games this week? That's not good for anybody, really. And, with the way Listella is hitting, I looked it up. Of the last six games, four of the starts in left field have been Chris Bryant. So that maybe tells you a lot about the way things are going to move going forward. And I don't know, getting back to the whole AAA thing, it might be better for Soler to go down to AAA and play every day and get his feet under him, get some confidence, and really, actually get a feel for the game again, because I really still don't think that this kid is going to be able to learn to be an everyday baseball player playing, a couple times a week.
Agreed.
How's he gonna? He's gonna take away at bats from Matt Mertin, though. We can't do that.
Oh yeah. Well,
sensible.
I mean this kind of half jokingly, but at some point, at what point in the season do we start talking about things keep going the way they are? Albert Almora and Jorge Soler essentially switching places.
Yeah, you wrote about that, and you said you talked about Almora playing the same role as the guy in the Red Sox. I'm blanking on his name.
Ellsbury.
Yeah. So I was wondering about that. So did you envision Almora playing left field?
Not specifically left field, but I guess what I was trying to say on that was I saw a lot of parallels to what happened with Ellsbury in 2007 with the Red Sox. Essentially, somebody got hurt Coco Crisp got hurt in late June. And didn't even hit the DL, just hurt for a week and couldn't play. And then Ellsbury got called up, got a little cup of coffee, hit well, came back up for a doubleheader as the 26th man, went back down, and then came back up September 1st and played extremely well in September, made some amazing catches in the outfield, played awesome defense, made the postseason roster, and then ended up having a three-hit game in the World Series. And then he was just, a big leaguer from that moment on. And it's half dreaming, that'd be so awesome if the same story played out for Almora. But it's also kind of half, this could be something that we could see from him. Now, not necessarily getting three hits in the World Series, but just, coming up midseason for a quick trip or even just September call-up and then maybe makes the postseason roster. Even just his defense is extremely valuable.
But wouldn't you be kind of switching in one issue for the same one? If we're saying that, Soler needs to get the at-bats, Now you're going to bring in a guy who's, you know, still very young at AAA, who probably needs, you know, to get those at-bats. Bring him in, put him in a position that's not his natural position, and ask him to kind of develop on the fly with not a full set of at-bats.
I don't know if saying going to left field is not his natural position, because it's still outfield, but in that situation, I don't see why they wouldn't put him in center field and put Dexter Fowler out in left, honestly.
At this point, wouldn't Elmore kind of play the same role Caesar is, though?
It depends. It depends on what Tommy Listell is doing at that point or how they're using him. I mean, again, we're talking a whole lot of hypotheticals really far down the road, and you know, Elmore getting to the big leagues probably is, if it's earlier than September, it's probably a case where somebody got injured.
Mm-hmm.
So, and not saying like Schwarber injury, like done for the year. I'm just saying throughout the natural course of the season, players are going to get hurt. There's going to be somebody who's going to miss a month. There's going to be somebody who's going to, you know, go on for 15 days. It's just going to happen. So, I don't know how exactly it would play out, but I'm sure if they did call him up in June or July, it's because he's going to go out there and play every day or close to it.
And I guess an argument on that behalf would be, at the plate, he can't be much worse than Soler, you know, kind of worst case scenario, and his defense would be a dramatic step up. So it would be at the very least a wash, you know, and probably better, certainly better on the defensive front.
I mean, he makes amazing contact at the plate.
Yeah, it's I think I thought the question initially was posed was, should we swap Soler for Elmore? I guess I agree that later in the season, you know, maybe July or August or something like that, if there is an injury, then you could bring him up. But
yeah, I just meant, at what point do we start discussing it? I didn't mean anytime soon. I just meant at some point this season.
He'd be a great guy to have on the roster when rosters expand, to have an extra guy who's just an elite defender. That'd be great.
Yeah, I just think that with Elmore, what we've seen from him, which is, this is actually surprising to me, because he was drafted as a guy that had an elite makeup, or, you know, so-called an elite makeup, but he has really struggled with his confidence the last couple of years. And actually, I interviewed him Friday at Iowa, and that's what he told me. He told me that the improvement that you've seen in his really his numbers since the end of last June, he's hitting 320, and his on base is about 390, nearly 390 in double A and triple A combined. But he told me that he didn't believe the mechanical changes really had that much to do with his success. He said that he switched his mindset, and he said he got his confidence back, and it was all kind of between the ears, and that was why he'd had a lot of success recently. It's a little bit surprising for me, because I actually sort of had this idea that he was one of those unflappable, unshakable guys.
He definitely exudes confidence. I think there's a home run that he hit recently where as he's rounding third base, he like turns and points to somebody in the stands, and I mean, he just, I don't know, I don't want to say cocky, but he kind of looks like he's a confident ball player.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he definitely comes across that way in person as well. He's fairly sure of himself. He's very humble. He comes across humble, but he knows that he was born and built to play baseball, you know, and he's out there as a guy that knows he's doing what he's supposed to be doing.
I think I was listening to that interview, and I think it's fascinating to hear, you know, the role of confidence. I mean, we've known this, we've heard this many times from many, many players in the past, how important it is to try to, you know, in a game where failure is just an everyday occurrence, to try to keep yourself confident that you know you can hit the ball. I was reading Mike Piazza's book. I can't remember what it was, Long Shot, I think it was called. And, you know, from the very beginning of his life, he had these very strong hands, and he knew he could hit the crap out of a baseball. But then he starts getting higher competition, better competition, and he starts to, those doubts start to creep in. And as soon as he gets back that mentality of, wait, no, I know I can do this, then that's when the performance starts to follow up. So that to me is really interesting.
Yeah, and actually that was one of the questions I posed him, was what effect Miguel Montero had on his season last year at AA. And he told me that Montero told him, hey, you need to go out there and play the game. You are good at baseball. Now act like it and go play the game. So he essentially said, look, I know you're not confident, you might be struggling, but you need to get out there and remember that you were born to do this, and you do need to do it. And then, you know, it appears that Almore kind of took that and took it to heart, and from that point on, he's been raking. So the confidence aspect of it, even from just playing, which you know, Carlos, the confidence aspect is probably far bigger than analytical minds really want to lend credence to.
Yeah, and we're going to go ahead and let's play a clip right now.
To me, the biggest thing for me was just confidence, man.
Okay.
The confidence is the biggest thing. The swing hasn't changed much besides the step and the leg kick now, but yeah, it's just been a confidence thing for me, and I'm really happy where I'm at right now. Sure.
What do you do to keep your confidence up when maybe times aren't as good, or you go through a period
of injuries? That's the thing, that's the tough thing about baseball. You know, when you're struggling, is to tell yourself that you're still, you're good at what you do.
Yeah.
It's just remember what you were doing when you were doing well, and from the confidence perspective, and just go out there and just do it. You know, it's just, man, the good thing about baseball is you go for the next day, it's a brand new day. So yeah. That's kind of what I go to.
Yeah.
It's a new day the next day, and try to stay positive. It leads to confidence.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, really fascinating stuff. It was really, really very interesting. You got to talk about that stuff.
Yeah. Good job.
Thanks, man.
So you mentioned Montero's opinions on Almora. Another guy that Montero has opinions on that he's been very public about is Wilson Contreras. He loved Contreras when he was down in was he in Double A? He was in Double A when he went for rehab, and he thought all these tweets about how great Contreras was. With Miguel Montero's injury, a lot of fans were saying, "Okay, we've been hearing about this great catching prospect. We're going to get to see him now, right?" And no, we got Tim Fedorovic, I believe. Did I get that right?
Fedorovic.
I knew I was going to butcher.
There was like 10 different ways to pronounce that name.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joel.
I know. I think you nailed it, though. So I didn't tell
you. No, I want you to give me all 10 ways.
Snuggles McFedorovic.
Sir Snuggles McFedorovic.
I still listen to that just when I need a pick-me-up, Joel, so thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Glad I could help you out there.
So yeah, the Montero injury. Fans expected to maybe get to see Contreras. What do we all think, Joel? What's your take on not seeing him, seeing Fedorovic instead?
Well, I think, like we talked about earlier, I think that Contreras. The understanding is that Montero's not going to be out too long, and so they don't want to kind of do the yo-yo thing with Contreras. They want to, if he's going to be up here, they want to give him significant time, and this was not that time. And we were talking about it before we started recording. I realized, I just kind of take whatever this front office does, I just kind of think, oh, well, that's the right thing to do. So I just assume that everything they do is smart and correct. So I think that leaving Contreras down to get more seasoning, and he's been hot at the plate lately, so, I think that just leave him there, let him just continue to develop and, work on his game. I think it's completely fine. I think this was the right call.
I agree with that, and I don't want to be the guy who just agrees just because I think they're smarter than I am, but that definitely kind of plays a small role in it. I trust that this organization knows what they're doing with their prospects, because to this point, the only one I could even make a case that they did something wrong is Jorge Soler, like we talked about, and even then, all of us thought it was the right thing at the time. So I thought it was interesting. I can't remember if it was Theo or if it was Jed or if it was Joe Madden who said that if they thought Miggy was going to be out longer, like a long period of time, that they would have called up Wilson Contreras to play. What do you guys think about that, basically admitting that they think he's ready enough at this point?
It was kind of interesting because when I was there on Friday, it was the first time I'd actually seen Contreras play in person. And he had one of the worst at-bats I've ever seen in my entire life, which was kind of surprising for a guy hitting 400 in Iowa. But
is that going to be the at-bat of the week this week?
I don't know. I was up in the press box actually laughing at the fact that, he's supposed to be the super polished hitter and kind of rough behind the plate. And I left the game pleased with his receiving skills and his cannon of an arm, and I thought he did a really good job. And then he just had one of the worst plate appearances I've ever seen. He struck out and ended up on his backside when he did it. So
nice.
I do think that, Ryan, you're probably right. If it was a longer-term injury, he might be up, or maybe you'd see Fedorovic for a couple of weeks, and then you would see Contreras come up. But I think they would have more of an eye on it if they were seriously concerned about Miggy.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned that you saw him have a bad blade appearance, but his receiving skills were good. I saw him play, and I was really watching him out in spring training, and it was late in the game. He got switched in, and I was trying to figure out all the moves, and I thought, oh, no, who do they have there at catcher? Please don't be Contreras, because he looks awful. and he got crossed up on a couple pitches, and it just looked really bad. And I wasn't exactly sure who was on the mound at that point, and you know, I was just trying to get everything sorted out. I'm like, man, this guy looks awful. And then John Arguello, who's also at the game, tells me, well, that was, Acevedo on the mound.
And Durie Acevedo.
Like, yeah, it throws like 97 with a 90-mile-an-hour slider. And he's just like, well, I think he's just having trouble handling a 90-mile-an-hour slider. And it's like, oh, well, that makes sense.
I mean, yeah.
He's probably never seen anything quite like that.
And the game was, it was a 1-0 game. He got the whole game. And I just thought it was impressive because the wind chill was about 35 in Des Moines on Friday. It was frigidly cold, and the wind was blowing, and it was just really bad conditions. But a couple different occasions that I saw him interact with his pitcher, I was really impressed with. I thought he handled the pitcher really well. From what I could tell, and it's always a little bit hard to tell, but from what I could tell, I thought he called a really good game. I liked his sequencing quite a bit. So his feet looked really good. He looked very agile, very athletic. And, I mean, all in all, I was pleasantly surprised with his defense. I will say that because I'd heard some kind of iffy reports. But
do we really need another catcher, though? I mean, we've got David Ross slugging 500 right now, so.
All-star candidate David Ross.
Yeah.
Isaac, I forgot to ask you, how did Almora look? Is he back? What was it, his ankle that got hurt?
No, and actually that was a bit of a false alarm because it was scary because he ripped a single into left field, just a kind of a classic Almora at bat. He took a kind of a high inside fastball and just turned on it and ripped it through the left side and came out of the box really slow and just kind of jogged down to first. And, you know, it was a 0-0 game. It's pretty intense at that point. And I thought, that's really strange. I'm really surprised that he did that. They immediately pinch ran for him right there, no hesitation. Mm. It took him out, and I thought, you know, oh, it's a rib cage. It's an oblique. He turned something. Something's wrong. So he walked back to the dugout, and then he was with the trainer. And in Iowa, their clubhouse is out beyond the left field wall. And they slowly walked out beyond the wall, but he looked like he was walking fine. So I found out after the game that it was just like a bug, a stomach flu bug of some variety. So that was really relieving, but I was pretty concerned that it was an oblique during the game.
Well, that's good to hear. So let's talk about another of the Cubs' new additions, Adam Warren. He hasn't had a chance to really fill that role that we envisioned of pitching multiple innings. But lately he's had, you know, a few more. We've been able to see a little bit more of him. What's your take, Ryan, on the role that Adam Warren's filled so far for the team?
I feel like it's pretty close to what I expected early for him. I thought that he was going to be kind of a late inning guy and maybe like be the sixth or seventh inning guy to go along with the eighth inning Pedro Strop, ninth inning Hector Rondon. And so far, I mean, they really haven't needed a lot of sixth, seventh inning guys. So he's just been kind of in there whenever they need an extra couple innings. He's followed Kyle Hendricks a few times. The guy has really good secondary stuff. Zach wrote about him on the site this week, and he actually cited back to something I wrote about him back in January. It kind of confirms some of my suspicions. He has like contact rates in the like 100s on his slider and changeup, but his fastball, which doesn't move a whole lot and sits around 93, and his sinker have been destroyed in his career. I mean, just in general, they get hit hard. And so I just kind of said, if he wants to have success, I'm kind of curious what Chris Bosio will do with him. Maybe scrap the sinker. Less fastballs, more secondary. And according to Zach, that's kind of what the research has said so far, is that he has barely thrown that sinker, and he's cut down the fastball usage to a much lower percent and gone with a lot more sliders and changeups. So that's been really good for him.
he just looks like a man out there. He looks like a big starting pitcher that can throw 250 innings.
Don't get Joel started. Don't get him excited this early.
He's a good looking guy too. I actually got to interview him back in January. If I'm gonna one up Isaac here about interviews, he was very nice too. It was very refreshing. He kind of talked at the Cubs convention about how excited he was to be in Chicago, and you kind of think, well, every player is gonna say that, right? And he mentioned like, he was the only one up there with the new Cubs that didn't get to choose coming to Chicago, but he was just as excited about it. And then meeting him face-to-face, talking to him about it, he legitimately was excited to be in Chicago. I totally believe him.
Jason Hayward, but Warren doesn't have a tribe of hillbillies with pitchforks and torches coming trying to burn his house down.
Easy now. You don't want to say anything that even resembles anything bad about the B-fib.
Was that bad? But that wasn't too derogatory, was it?
You just called them hillbillies with pitchforks. I don't know.
I'm just stating the facts.
They prefer, the PC word for hillbilly is sons of the soil. That's what they prefer.
Yeah, well, I think I will go along with that one then.
So, on Warren, can I ask, should he have been used more in the kind of two-inning role this year? Because I'll speak for John Lackey. I said before the game today that I would pull him after five innings indiscriminately, and they ended up scoring two runs on him in the sixth inning. Yes, there was an error by someone we won't speak of negatively, but should Madden have been giving more chances to his middle relievers since they're there, and that's why they're there especially for Lackey and Hendricks so far this year?
I mean, I'd have to look at Lackey's career numbers, especially last year, what he did between like 60 and 90 pitches. Just based on what I've seen from him, and I wrote something out about it too, in most of his recent career, when he gets hit hard, it's usually the first inning, and then he settles down from there. So any kind of numbers that say that he gets hit hard after 60 pitches is probably mostly related to the first few starts of this year. And just in general, I don't buy that small of a sample of four games. I'd have to see a longer stretch where I see that. But maybe you have that data. I just don't. What I've seen on him is that he gets hit hard in the first inning if he does get hit.
Well, one of the things I'm trying to uncover in my pitching progress series on the Wrigleyville site is anticipating what is going to happen before it happens. And that was why I tweeted that before the game today to say, okay, look, he's been awful in the sixth inning. He's allowing an OPS of almost 1,100 in the sixth inning and beyond so far this year. On base is about 480 on him against him in the sixth inning. The biggest reason that I see it this year and am kind of separating it from previous years is that he's seeing serious velocity drops at right around 60 pitches every time out. He starts around 93.5, 94 miles per hour, and by the sixth inning he's throwing 90, 91, and it's kind of just a solid straight line down from the first inning down to the sixth inning for his velocity, and it's showing up in the results. He's getting hit hard, he's trying to compensate and dropping down, and he ends up walking people as well. And I just wonder if that's exactly why we've got Clayton Richard and Travis Wood and Adam Warren, and if Madden should be a little bit more proactive about actually getting those guys in before seeing the warning signs on Lackey, because the warning signs are coming too late, and he's already got two or three guys on and has allowed runs. Just curious as to your thoughts on that.
I think we might be able to tie this back to the confidence bit that we spoke about at the beginning. And, you know, I get it. And I think one of the things, two things that have been kind of disappointing for me this season is, you know, this philosophy of how they were going to use these middle relievers to kind of step up and fill the innings boost and pull your starters early. I was looking forward to that, to seeing that and how it played out. Haven't been able to see much of it. And also looking forward to seeing Schwarber and having these, you know, three catcher rotation system. I was looking forward to seeing that. Haven't seen that. But I see your point about Madden maybe being more proactive. How, you know, that might impact a player's confidence, right? If you know that no matter what, if you got a one hitter going and they're going to pull you after six because, well, we got all this bunch of data on my desk that says I should pull you, you know, over 162 games, is it worth it?
Yeah, and really what I wanted to comment on is kind of what Isaac said is, again, more data is needed. Is it an early season issue where he's getting tired after five innings, or, you know, in the last two or three years, has his velocity dropped in the later innings and he's just used his control and it's not been a big of a problem? I don't know that because I haven't researched it yet, but I think the idea of just going into it saying, here's John Lackey with a, you know, pretty recent run of decent success, four games in, we're just going to decide we're going to start pulling him after the fifth inning. I don't know that you do that with a veteran like him until you start to see that it's a long-term problem. And then you probably are exploring every option to see, you know, maybe does he need us to skip a start? Does he need to, you know, do we need to do something different with him? Is it a medical issue where he needs to go on the DL and work up his arm strength? I think there's a whole lot that would need to be explored before I would just decide, hey, this guy that we brought in, who is our, you know, penciled in as the game three starter once we get to the playoffs, four games into the season, let's just, you know, no more than five innings. Yeah, you know, I just wouldn't do that without exploring other options first.
Isaac, I wonder, I'm looking at Lackey's pitch count, and I don't have today's, but so far this season he's at 84, 90, 91, 95. What would you want him to be? And so that's question number one. I want to ask you that question. Number two, I want to support what Carlos said, because I think that, you know, and this kind of came up last week when we were talking about Arrieta's no-hitter. And I think that these guys, like, yeah, I think that Arrieta, I can't speak for Lackey, I think Arrieta's a very smart guy, and he's probably reasonable and would listen, and he admitted that last season he was pretty exhausted toward the end of the season. He just didn't have any gas left in the tank. But I don't know that they would be like, oh, you want to pull me after, you know, because the data says that after 74 pitches, my velocity drops. I'm cool with that. Like, I don't know that they would be, you know, and I think that you're getting kind of a, there was that story in the New York Times by the guys who, from Baseball Prospectus, who ran that minor league team, and they tried to do it just by the numbers, and that, you know, you do have to take the human element into account. So I wanted to get your thought on that as well.
Yeah, there's kind of a lot there. There's a lot of good questions there. I'm a strong believer in the human element being a big part of this, but I'm also a huge believer in Joe Maddon's ability to really effectively communicate these types of things, especially to veterans and guys that get it. John Lackey and Joe Maddon are very good friends. They've known each other for a long time. And I hear what you're saying, Ryan, about saying, look, he's a veteran, we need a bigger sample size. I agree with that. But this goes back to the crux of the point of having four middle relievers. And the whole point is to make sure that John Lackey and Jake Arrieta and the rest of the starters are primed and ready to go in October. It's April. And that's my point of saying, why are you going to leave a guy out there in the sixth inning in April when the whole point is that they need to be fresh, you know, in October? And that was my same point with Arrieta, which is to say, it really doesn't mean much at this point. So if you go out there and he throws you five solid innings, it's a 1-0 game. That's enough. He's been struggling into the sixth inning. Maybe it's actually better for the guy's confidence to take him out after he's had a good start when he's had a couple of not so good ones in a row before this. So I think that the bigger goal gets lost sometimes when we look at individual starts, and the whole thing is keeping Clayton Richard fresh, keeping Travis Wood fresh with some innings, and saving John Lackey for when we really, really need him in October.
I hear what you're saying, but the problem I have with it is deciding that you're going to go in and pull a guy who's throwing really well through five innings because he's thrown like 60 pitches. I mean, if you bring in the bullpen and then the game goes to extra innings, which it did, and you get into the 13th, 14th inning, you know, it's really easy to look back at Joe Maddon and say, why the hell did you pull John Lackey at 60 pitches in the fifth? I mean, you just don't see that around baseball. It's just one of those, like, why would you intentionally do that? You're going to give the guy more of a leash, especially early on, to prove, if he's at 85 pitches, I completely agree.
You just said something, though. I think you just made the point, didn't you? You said you don't see that around baseball. I think that's the point I'm trying to make, isn't it? Is that, yeah, you don't see it, and maybe you should a little bit more, especially when you've got eight relievers.
Well, I don't know. And here, I pulled up on my phone exactly what happened in that sixth inning you're referring to. It was one solid base hit, of 104 miles an hour on the ground into center field. Then it was a walk, a sack bunt, an intentional walk to try and get a double play. And guess what? A 94 mile an hour batted ball on the ground to Addison Russell. And the note that it has on here in like the official game wrap, lucky break for the Braves. Garcia hits a no doubt double play ball to short, but Addison Russell couldn't corral it. Everyone safe, 2-0 Atlanta. And then there is another double play ball, this one on the ground at 63 miles an hour, according to StatCast, which did turn a double play, but the Braves got a run because of the way it was scored. So I don't feel like he struggled that hard in the sixth inning, and then he pitched well in the seventh and came back out and pitched well in the eighth. I mean, I just don't see, I don't really understand the point of let's pull him after 63 pitches and then, I mean, I just don't see what the complaint is in John Lackey's game today. Eight innings, two earned runs.
It's actually not in John Lackey's game that my complaint is at all. The other thing is it was a 1-0 game in the bottom of the fifth, and I would have loved to see somebody else get that at bat as opposed to Lackey in the fifth inning. That was a big part of it too. Again, I think this goes to the overarching thing of saying you got five solid innings out of him. You gave away an at bat when you didn't necessarily need to, and the goal is still in October. I guess just trying to make sure that guys in the bullpen get work and save the horses for October when you need them.
I guess my final point on it will be I would assume Joe Maddon knows his players better than we do, and with a veteran like Lackey, I don't know exactly how Lackey would handle Maddon saying, hey, you know, today after you pitched five good innings and I know your arm feels strong and you're feeling going good, but we're going to pull you at 60 pitches in a 1-0 game because we want to get the bullpen work. I don't know how Lackey handles that. I don't know if Maddon thinks that's a good idea to do with a veteran. If it were Kyle Hendricks or another young pitcher, that might be a different story. And that's, I guess, the last point I'll make on it.
Yeah, I hear that.
I think it brings up a very good point about, A, how hard it is to be a major league manager, and B, just the amount of things that they have to kind of think about. You know, have the starters gotten enough starts to kind of get on a roll to start the season versus what you're point, Isaac, of, all right, well, that's enough. Now let's remember that we're supposed to save these guys so that what really counts is the playoffs. So there's so many things, and it's like it's an art, right, to try to manage all this stuff.
It definitely is, and I think that's a valid point saying Maddon knows these guys better, and that's part of it. I think that's definitely fair. I guess it just flummoxes me in one way that we're not using the bullpen in the way we set out to. It is a testament to the success of the starting rotation, which is a great problem to have. But I do worry about guys like Richard and Warren and Wood staying somewhat fresh.
And I do kind of agree with that. Sorry to kind of cut you off, Joel, but I do agree with that. I've been, you know, kind of wondering, like, hey, where are these six-inning starts for Arrieta? You're still kind of seeing it. It's like September of 2015 all over again with some of the way he's been used.
Yep.
The no-hitter withstanding, because I think we can all agree on him going nine innings in that game. But maybe Isaac doesn't want to agree, but we probably shouldn't go.
We'll speak for him on that one.
Yeah, we'll speak for him and say we agree. But yeah, other than that, I'd love to see him go out there. I did like that he got pulled after five innings in the last game. I thought that was great.
I'm just looking at Arrieta's pitch count. So you've got 89, 99, 100, 119, which was the no-hitter, and 92. So I don't want to belabor this point. I know we've been talking about it for a while. So first of all, Isaac, I want to give you props for using the word flummoxed, by the way. That was pretty sweet.
Thanks.
And secondly, on average, I want to say that's about 90, 98 pitches for Arrieta. What do you think would be good? Like, ideal... In an ideal world, how many pitches is Arrieta throwing per game in April, May, etc.?
You know, I don't really boil this down to pitch counts as much, especially not with Arrieta. I just, for one, I didn't like 100. I've been outspoken about that too, and I apologize, but I didn't like the 119 pitches. I'd like to see low pitch counts. In general, I think it's just about saying, okay, we've constructed our team this way. We have a short bench because we've constructed our team this way. We believe this is the path to success.
That was the plan.
It was the plan, and then they've completely abandoned it because the starting pitching has pitched well. And I'm going, okay, that defeats the purpose because the starting rotation is supposed to pitch well, and you're still supposed to use those middle relievers often because you need the starting pitchers to pitch well in October. And because they're pitching well is not a good enough reason for me to not follow the roster construction plan that was set in place.
I guess all we need is a couple of tests, right? Put those guys in, and if they start bombing, then it'll be easy to say, all right, leave the starters in, because these guys
totally
are
as totally fair. Totally fair. That's definitely fair. And I think what we've seen out of Adam Warren has been really encouraging, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So far so good.
And I think most of the bullpen's been pretty encouraging. I mean, Neil Ramirez had one rough game, and drawing a blank on who else. Clayton Richard had, you know, one of the times he's been out there. God, I feel like I missed two games, and he pitched in both of them, so I haven't seen him at all this year.
I literally have not seen him pitch.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just feel like I get what you're saying, and I'm totally on board with the overall usage of the starting rotation and the fact that they've had eight guys in the bullpen all season, and they've all been healthy, so I don't understand why they haven't been used more frequently.
Yeah.
But, again, I don't know. I guess I try to trust Joe Maddon and defer to him just because, you know, this isn't Dusty Baker out there just kind of mismanaging and being clueless. This is, you know, the king of, like, you know, the onion layer of ideas and, like, you know, all the things he's doing having a purpose. So, I don't know. I'd like to know more about why it's been done the way it has, because I'm sure there's a reason.
Meanwhile, Dusty Baker's team is 17-7.
Yeah, I was gonna say something about that. Like, and I think we can talk about that more at another time when there's more to get to. But, you know, I think he gets a little bit of a short shrift. You know, I think that, you know, when he was with the Giants, he got him every year. It was going to be like, well, this is the year that, you know, it's only Bonds, and he's, you know, they got nothing else, and this is the year they're going to be in third or fourth place, and every year they'd make the playoffs. And he got within a couple outs of winning the World Series against the Angels. And then, of course, 2003, you know, he got the Cubs within a couple outs of the World Series. So, I mean, you know what Dusty Baker reminds me of? He reminds me of that P.T. Anderson movie Magnolia. Like, every time people criticize it, I'm like, yep, I completely agree with every criticism you're making, but I still liked it. And so everything people say about Dusty Baker, you know, his misuse of the pitchers and his overuse of the pitchers and him, you know, the cool guy with hiding behind the kid when he made bad decisions and just not going out to comfort Pryor in game six, all that. It's all accurate. But I mean, he does succeed numerically. He's a pretty successful manager. And I know you could get into, well, he goes to teams with good players, but, you know, I mean, look at Matt Williams last year. So,
I mean, let's not forget when he came over to the Cubs, there was buzz. I mean, this is a huge name for the Cubs to have brought on as their manager. I mean, he was spoken of very highly, and it wasn't until, you know, he started saying some of these silly quotes and leaving pitchers in for 172 pitches that he started to kind of develop this reputation. But before that, he was like, I remember being incredibly excited when they signed him.
Yeah,
and that's. I remember talking to a Giants fan online around that time and him saying, yeah, you know, everyone's excited about Dusty Baker and with good reason, but, you know, there's a reason Giants fans are saying so long, you know, adios, and basically, you know, you won't realize it until you see it on a everyday basis. Yeah, like him, you know, bad in-game management, a lot of the excuses and all that. Joel, you brought up, you were comparing Dusty Baker. I've always thought of him like the NBA comparison is George Karl, the guy who just keeps getting jobs based on some past successes, even though he's, you know, at this point, it feels like his era has kind of gone by. And like George Karl got the job with the Kings and everyone was kind of just scratching their heads like, really, why? You know, is there really nobody better than this?
Well, yeah, I mean, I see that point, but George Karl, the Kings sucked this year, but look at the Nats. I mean, granted, it's early, but, you know, they're kind of kicking ass.
I feel like with just how bad Matt Williams was last year and the fact that they also endured so many injured players and lost so many games to injury, it almost seemed like Dusty might have been like the perfect candidate just to come in and sit on his hands and just let this team be them and be the player's manager. And it might have been a brilliant hire in that respect, just because you can deal with the bad in-game management, because, you know, maybe you don't have guys ripping each other's heads off in the clubhouse, and maybe just better health means a better team.
Or yeah. Ripping their necks out in the dugout.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, when they hired Baker, I was like, I was rolling my eyes, and I was kind of with everyone, I'm like, yeah, that's a bad move, but I mean, I'm pretty surprised at what he's doing so far, and I, you know, again, it's a pretty small sample size, and Ryan Watt wrote about it on BP, the main site, about how, you know, there he is mismanaging the game in the extra innings last week, but they won the game, you know, and the players love him, so there might, you know, there's something to be said for what he does, and maybe we talked about it with Madden. It's like, you know, he probably knows better than we do, and Dusty's doing something, and the nerds are rattling their pocket protectors, but he's leaving them in too long, and that's certainly true, but he's winning, you know? So, I mean, and we'll see what happens, and I would love to see the Cubs playing them in the playoffs, because, you know, if you've got Madden versus Baker, you're talking chess versus checkers, but still, you know, the guy has a pretty impressive track record just when it comes to wins and losses.
That's kind of funny you say that, and yes, we resemble that nerd comment, and we're angry, but there's actually parallels to me between Dusty Baker and Joe Madden, and I'm not comparing the two, but I'm just saying, like, what they do best is the intangible. You know, it's the relationship with the players. It's keeping a medium when things are going really well or really poorly. It's really all these kind of intangible things. I think another guy I would compare Dusty Baker to that the nerds just cannot stand is Ned Yost. I think he's really good in the clubhouse, and the players love playing for him. But he's going to do all these things that make you really want to tear your hair out. But he's successful, and it's hard to get beyond the fact that players love to play for him, and they succeed for him.
I thought you were going to go with Mike Matheny, because there's a big comparison there. Batting game management. In general, the fans and the media don't really like him because he's not that personable outside of the clubhouse. But by all accounts, everybody loves playing for Mike Matheny. And, you know, sure enough, the Cardinals have been extremely successful with him.
I think that's a kind of another parallel as those three with him, but yeah, very good.
I mean, you know, and here I've been talking about Baker and kind of talking him up, but he will forever, you know, when you think about him saying he doesn't want guys clogging the Bates pass. I mean, yeah. Have you heard a dumber quote in your life? I mean, for real. For real. Come on.
That was the moment, like, that I
clown
realized.
Clown quote, bro.
Yeah, that was the moment I realized just how bad he was, because at that point I think I was still writing off some of the things he said as, well, maybe he's just bad at conveying his thoughts. Maybe he means this, but he said this. You know, kind of making excuses for him. And when he said that, it was like, there's literally nothing else he can mean there. He is just dumb.
Yeah. I think we digress. I think it's time for a new segment.
Well, before we do, let me just say one. All these descriptions of Dusty Baker, and the one that came to mind was Cosmo. Speaking of Cosmo Kramer, what is it? Has no job, dates beautiful women, and falls ass backwards into piles of cash. Sounds like kind of Dusty Baker's style right there.
That's so harsh.
I mean, life
is harsh.
He does have a job.
I just want to say, I do hope he wins a World Series ring. Just not anytime soon and against the Cubs. But, like, because he came so close with the Giants. You know, they were up by, what, 5 in the 8th inning in game 6, and, you know, he let the guy keep the ball, and then the Angels got really mad and they scored all these runs, and they were up by 3, I forget, but anyway, so the point is that he has come really close, and he's not like a dick, you know. I think everyone agrees with that. Like, Ned Yost, not a very cool guy, like, but so I don't know. I kind of root for Dusty, despite, again, agreeing with every criticism you can levy against him. So
you're such a nice guy, Joel.
Yeah, that's what I do.
You are a nice guy. I would say he's a dick, but that's mostly because after the whole Chapman thing came out, he basically went out there and apologized for him and called him a great guy. And
yeah, that was pretty bad.
That killed anything left I had for him personally. Just because I feel like that's a pretty scummy thing to do.
Okay, yeah, you make a good point.
Speaking of scummy, Joel, who are we talking about? I really don't even know who it is today. Who do we have for 60 seconds?
Mr. Scummy McSnuggles.
We're going to talk about Hector Villanueva, and I want to say we got a reader wrote in, or listener rather, wrote in with that suggestion, but I want to say I had actually looked at him for previous weeks, but I thought it was too close to George Mitterwald, and I didn't want to do too many catchers right in a row, although I've also done Michael Barrett, so they seem to have something going on there with the backstops. But so anyway.
Of course you do. I just brought up a picture of Hector Villanueva. He looks a little Kyle Schwarberish with a mustache.
Yeah.
But anyway.
So you say Villanueva, not Villanueva. I've westernized it or Americanized it, I guess.
Yeah, as usual, Americans butchering everything. That's fine.
Yeah, no bitterness. So I'm ready to rock this town, rock it inside out.
All right, let's get some good nicknames out there. Ready? Go.
Two words you wouldn't think applied to mustachioed, rotund former Cubs catcher Hector Villanueva, low calorie. Two others, Triple Crown. And yet the Zaftig backstop was indeed the Triple Crown winner of the Puerto Rican League in 1991, the year after he first played for the Northsiders. The Rubenesque Villanueva hit three homers in his first six games with the Cubs, and thusly, the 240-pound catcher became a local hero. In 1991, he had five consecutive hits over two games, and three of them were homers. But more impressive was the pinch triple the barrel-chested Puerto Rican legged out in a come-from-behind 5-4 August win against the Padres of San Diego. Alas, the corpulent Villanueva waddled too close to the sun, and his all-too-brief tenure as a portly member of the Cubs ended after three seasons, swatting 22 homers and 457 at bats. He finished his full-figured career with one season at the St. Louis Cardinals in 1993, but the bulbous backstop continued to play across the globe, gracing teams in Atlantic City, Taiwan, and Mexico with his Paul Russia-like frame and his Paul Sprung-like swing.
Very well. Rotund, corpulent, there was some good stuff in there.
We avoided using fat. Good job.
Bulbous backstop. Real quick on Villanueva, Carlos, when you mentioned that he looked like Schwarber, I had to look him up because I couldn't picture him. And yeah, he does kind of look like he's just got a mustache. And the first thing that came up was the back of a baseball card. And first of all, it says Rising Star
on it. And the A is a star.
Yeah, and it just says, and this is the back of his baseball card, says, Hector, a roly-poly rookie.
Oh, I didn't use that one. Damn it.
Oh my word.
Oh my god, that it says roly poly rookie.
That's hilarious.
That's incredible. I just pulled it up. The score. I love the score.
Yeah.
We're gonna put a side by side up tomorrow on Twitter for the fans.
Well, it's amazing. You know, in doing research on him, so I see one card has him listed at 220, an article had him listed at 240, and then toward the end of his career when he's playing like the Mexican League, they referred to him as 280. So now he must be like 400.
Look at that. If you've still got it up, Joel, look at that. Like the fifth picture from the left, though. He has the mustache shaved, and it's an Iowa Cubs picture. Yeah, but he looks like Kyle Schwarber.
He does. I agree. He does.
That's funny.
Yeah. Oh, good choice.
Thanks. Good. Thanks to the listener who suggested. Just reinforced that. That was a gold mine, Hector Villanueva.
All right, who do we have? What do we have?
One thing, real quick. So in the game, he hit his triple. Jim Essien referred to it as an inside the park triple.
Amazing.
That's fantastic. I tried to work that in, but that made too many words.
You almost made me do a spit take because I was drinking some water when you said that. That was great.
That's funny. All right, Ryan, what do we have for question of the week?
All right, so I decided because it was the end of April to go with question of the week this week was me asking a question of the fans. And I ran a Twitter poll and said this week's question of the week is who is the Cubs MVP of April? And the options I gave were Jake Arrieta, Dexter Fowler, Jason Hamill, and Anthony Rizzo. Did you guys peek at the results on this?
I did, yes.
Okay. So I'll ask Isaac and Carlos then, because Joel already saw. Who would you have voted for and why?
Go ahead, Isaac.
I actually did vote, and for me it's pretty easy. Dexter Fowler.
Yeah, I did the same thing.
He was worth like a win and a half, warp-wise. 474 on base. I just... this goes back to the conversation we had after, I think, 3 weeks when we were talking about what the Cubs' record would be without him, and I really feel like he definitely contributed the most in the win column compared to anyone. Arrieta was great, Hamill was great, but Fowler was the guy we couldn't have been without.
Yeah, I looked at this when I first woke up, and
that's good to know.
I was like, oh, it's got to be Arrieta, but then I was like, no, it's clearly Fowler. And then I was thinking, well, maybe playing devil's advocate, but yes. I mean, well, Fowler, though, his on-base percentage is under 500, so, you know, I don't know, falling off the cliff there.
Yeah, he's not off to a good start for being on the Maypole, just saying. But, No, he got 75% of the vote from the fans. Yeah. So that tells you most of the people, you know, paying attention were right there with us. Jake Arrieta got 19%. I can understand, you know, for him second. It did surprise me that Anthony Rizzo only got 4% of the vote, though.
We have an intelligent audience.
Yeah. I mean, I expected more from him. I didn't think he was the MVP, but I thought he's got a great on base and a great slugging, and he hit 8 home runs. You know, a couple of them were big home runs. I was expecting Rizzo to get more consideration, but Fowler, I feel like, is the clear answer, and that's what everybody else came up with. And we had 223 votes on the poll, so
nice.
A decent sample of people saying it as well.
Just real quick, though, Jake Arrieta is at 1.8 WAR, Dexter Fowler 1.6.
Wow.
Yeah, that's. So. I thought Arrieta would be the competition for him. It surprised me that he scored so high, especially with Arrieta throwing a no-hitter and being 5-0 and 5 starts with a 1 ERA.
Good job, voters.
Yeah.
Very cool.
All right. And bat of the week, correct?
Yeah. And we know it's not Wilson Contreras in Iowa.
No, it's not. And actually, the at-bat of the week, in my opinion, the two most exciting at-bats both came from the same person. But that could have been.
Oh, my God.
John Lackey, right?
I'm going to break out my baseball and throw it in the air.
John Lackey, yeah. What would we do if we couldn't argue, Ryan? It was today. Today's at-bat of the week. In the ninth inning, the Cubs were behind by 2, right? By 2 or by 1? No, by 1. 3-2 going into the ninth. They scored in the eighth. Yeah, sorry. Ben Zobrist did what he does and walked to lead off the inning. Tommy La Stella did what he doesn't do and struck out for the first out. And then this was really interesting because Vizcaino was kind of mildly tossing throws over to first base for no apparent reason. And the thought ran through my head, what are you doing? You're not trying to pick him off. You're not even making him stay closer to the base. All you're doing is, you know, threatening to throw the ball down the first base line. Sure enough, he turns and pivots and fires the ball straight into the ground for no apparent reason down the first base line. And Zobrist is able to take third, go from first to third on the air. So Addison Russell is now up with the tying run 90 feet away, with one out in the ninth inning. He takes two really, really vicious sliders, swung at one and took the other one. Both of those pitches, if you look at PitchFX, one is right on the black and the other one is about an inch off the black. Just excellent pitches, kind of gave you a feeling of all the tantalizing potential that Aroldis Vizcaino has. The third one was yet another really nice slider, and this one was actually about 3 inches off the plate outside. And where he had pulled off of the first two sliders, Russell stayed with the third one. His front side shoulder stayed in. He went with the pitch into right center field and drove a line drive into right center field to tie the game, scoring Ben Zobrist from third to tie it at 3-3. It, of course, didn't go well in the 10th inning, but for the ninth, Russell played hero. That's your at-bat of the week.
I think we need to put a moratorium on Addison Russell. No. Getting at-bats of the week.
You know what, though? I agree, but at the same time, I think he had probably the two most prominent at-bats, that and the two-run triple that he had on, was that Friday? Thursday or Friday?
I thought that Chris Bryant's at-bat in the eighth inning was at least as big, but
it was good.
I wouldn't say it was, you know, better than Russell's. I just thought, you know, he worked. I want to say he started 1-2 or 0-2 in that count, worked it to 3-2, and then hit the single to left field that scored two runs.
Yeah, it was actually the I'm not sure which one you're talking about, because it was the second pitch that he hit that single on. It was 0-1. But that was a huge at-bat. Yeah, that was a great at-bat as well. I just thought that the game-tying hit had to probably be the bigger play.
Sure. Very encouraging, too, from Addison Russell, like to do that on a really, really good series of pitches. I was very impressed.
That's the biggest part, I think, is all three of those sliders were very good sliders. And the third one being off the plate and still just going with it, I agree. That was what really encouraged me, too.
You know, I want to say just one thing real quick. I was looking at Addison Russell's stats. His on-base percentage is pretty good at 341. It's decent, but you know, his batting average is 214. I'm looking at the other averages: 208 for Montero, Rizzo 218, Russell 214, Bryant 289, Soler 189, Hayward 224, and they're still kicking ass, you know. So just like, it's amazing how well they're doing. I know we've talked about this, and this has been said a million times, but it's just really encouraging to see them put together this great record when their offense is really, and they get the great run differential and everything, and yet you still could make a really strong argument that it has not even come really close to reaching its potential.
That's a great point. I mean, when the big guns in the lineups really get it going, who knows what will happen.
Yeah.
And actually, I think a fair bit of that is bad luck. I don't really want to play this card at all, but we talked about the crazy low BABIP that Rizzo had going into last week. I think it was like 112 or something, 120 maybe. And then if you look at Russell's BABIP, he's only at 236. So he's probably about a 315 to 320 true BABIP player, and last year he was 324. This year he's 236, so you know that's going to come up, and his batting average will come up with it.
Yeah, and I actually wrote something about Russell for a different site where I made kind of the same argument, where I was looking at his batting average on balls in play and how low it was, and there was a whole bunch of other stuff that I found in my research that was also kind of surprising. He's hitting the ball harder.
Yeah, yes.
Like that's like, and I'm pulling it up on my phone right now so I can give you the exact, his soft contact in 2015, and granted, and we're just looking at batting average here, but it was 248. His soft contact was 20.4%. That's down to 16.7%. His medium contact is up 2%, and his hard contact is up over 2%. Mm-hmm. So he's hitting the ball harder, and he's making more outs on balls in play. He's also dropped his his K percentage from 28.5% to 18%.
Huge.
Yeah, so I mean, he's done everything right, but his batting average, for whatever reason, the balls are going right at guys. So I don't know what they do about that other than say, keep doing what you're doing, and they're going to fall in for hits.
Speak to me softly, I like this. No, but it is so encouraging, because his walks and hit by pitches, he has 14, which is the same amount of strikeouts that he's got. So
yeah,
it's a small sample, but for a player that's 22 years old, what is he, 23 now? I think he's still 22. He's 22. For a player that just turned 22 in January to have the same amount of strikeouts and walks over the course of a month, that's huge progress, and I think that says a lot about his future.
Totally agree. So I think that's all we got. It's going to be an interesting week with the Cubs going to Pittsburgh, face the Pirates, and then got four games with the Nationals after that. So I think we're going to have a lot of good stuff to talk about next week.
Hopefully.
I'll be at the game on Saturday next week. So.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Cool. I'm excited about that, taking my daughter to the game.
Oh, that's
very fun.
She's been, right?
Yeah, she went last year and got to run the bases on a Sunday.
That's right.
So nice. It'll be tough explaining to her that that's not an every game thing. So, but yeah, we're looking forward to it. It's perfect for her. It's a 3:00 start, so we'll get up there, get to the game, then be able to get home by reasonable time.
Time cool. For some ice cream on the way home.
Oh yeah.
Nice.
Cool. All right. Well, don't forget to review us on iTunes and send us questions. We love getting these questions. You guys have good questions, good analysis, too, on the poll. So you can reach us on Twitter at BP Wrigleycast, and you can email us at bpwrigleycast@baseballperspectives.com. I think that's it. So have a good night, guys.
All right.
Take care, fellas.
Thanks, guys.